Hi everyone. Thank you for coming out tonight and supporting the Mac for Africa event. My name is Siddhi Mather. I'm one of the event coordinators with Mac for Africa. Today's actually a really exciting night because we have veteran journalist and documentary filmmaker Larry Cross with us, and he's volunteered here to give us a talk on the ethical implications of doing humanitarian work in Africa, and also he's going to be talking to us about his book, The Uncertain Business of Doing Goods, Outsiders in Africa. So, first off, I'd like to welcome Larry Cross.
Thanks, Siddhi, and thank you for being here. I am delighted to be here, and I want first off to express my appreciation to the Mac for Africa group for inviting me, and to Siddhi and to Brendan Stone for making me welcome and paving all the little bumps in the road for me to be here this afternoon. I should say, first of all, the talk isn't going to last an hour, so you can relax. It'll be somewhat less than an hour, but I think what I will do is I will read a little bit from my book to kind of put us in location, and then I have a bit of a speech or a talk that is kind of develops the thesis that I tried to make in the book, and that I think the whole context for the bit that I'm reading is more memoir rather than analysis, or I'll just leave it at that and read a section called "Looking for a Prostitute." On a bright morning in December 1996, I made my way along a breeze-filled corridor in the University of Nairobi Medical School. A rabbit's warren of offices, many of them in need of a good paint job, opening off open-air hallways and staircases. I was looking for Dr. Elizabeth Ngugi, who had promised to put me in touch with a prostitute. Many prostitutes, actually. I had come to Nairobi to scout locations and interviews for a film, this time about the research that Canadian and, to a lesser degree, American and British scientists were doing in a shantytown with a group of sex workers who, despite the fact that they had sex several times a day with truck drivers, never became infected with HIV. This extraordinary discovery both puzzled and enthralled the scientific world and provoked people like me to want to find out more about the story. Dr. Ngugi, the director of community health for Kenya, had been the main contact between the women and the scientists for almost 10 years. She was going to be my connection, too. I found her at her desk, barely visible behind a chaotic stack of files and papers. To say I was apprehensive would have been an understatement. Dr. Ngugi was highly respected, but I had been warned that she could be acerbic, or even unpredictable, and nobody wanted to get on her wrong side. A small woman with sharp edges, she stood up and removed her glasses. An automobile accident had put out one of her eyes and disfigured her face, but the fearsome thing was something below the surface. She had the personality of a coiled spring. "Yes," she said, "she had already arranged for me to meet the chairperson of the prostitutes committee. I would find this person in one of the slums, a place called Matari." The good doctor herself was far too busy to accompany me, but her assistant, a friendly-looking woman named Lynette, who had just breezed into the room, would go with me. While she had us in her office, though, Dr. Ngugi was going to provide a lecture. She moved around to the side of her desk. "When people say prostitute," she said with the ring of a warning, "they only see a woman, not the man. The prostitute, however, is not simply the person who sells sex, but also the person who buys the sex." Her point was that if there was any stigma, it should be spread around. She was a champion of the women and determined to protect them from having to carry all the burdens by themselves. Here, of course, they weren't prostitutes anyway. They had been given the far more dignified title of commercial sex workers. And the very fact that they were organized and had a chairperson was in no small measure due to Dr. Ngugi's influence. Eventually, Lynette and I were let go and soon were making our way through the city in the doctor's chugging yellow Isuzu van. Nairobi was built as a junction on the railway from the Indian Ocean coast of Mombasa to Kampala in Uganda. What ultimately became the Kenyan capital city is at about the halfway point, a good day's trip from both other cities. It is on high ground, almost 2 kilometers above sea level, which gives it a moderated climate and no malarial mosquitoes. Driving through Nairobi made me happy. By that time, I'd already been twice to Kenya as well as Zimbabwe, Angola, and a tiny corner of Zambia. In the same manner it has with other travelers, Africa was getting hold of me. There were moments back home on some wintry days when I would close my eyes and daydream a landscape of acacia trees or conjure the recollection of a precise moment of being seated at a breakfast table with a certain whiff of breeze entering through the open window. It didn't matter that these trips I made usually involved looking at people's troubles. An attraction that was entirely sentimental and romantic had taken hold. Riding in the subway or walking on the street in Toronto, or when I'd be in some other city like London, I might overhear a fragment of conversation in just the right accent, which would be enough to send me into roils of happy sadness, itching to find the means to buy another ticket. I could now only embrace as good fortune the fact that I had a chance to stay in Kenya for a couple of months and have it paid for by the National Film Board of Canada. You fools. Like all African cities, Nairobi has become horrifically overcrowded. The pleasant colonial suburbs increasingly overwhelmed by burgeoning shanty towns, one of which we were heading toward this morning. When we got there, we certainly knew it. Entering the slum was like hitting a wall. Immediately, a press of people, carts, and bicycles reduced our progress to a snail's pace. Lynette, grasping the steering wheel with tense knuckles, pushed resolutely ahead, while I couldn't help but notice that whenever we reached a particularly tight spot where I might think there was no more possibility, magically, in front of us, like the Red Sea, the crowd would part. Lynette looked over at me. "Everybody recognizes Dr. Ngugi's car," she said. Eventually, however, even that wasn't enough, and we truly could drive no further. We abandoned the car and set off on foot under the broiler of the late morning sun. We entered immediately into a maze of pathways, narrow and well-beaten, snaking amongst mud-sided huts. The huts were completely makeshift, but at the same time quite tidy, in the way I realized you have to be when your existence is precarious in the face of rain and wind and sun. Some had tin roofs, others were covered by sheets of plywood. A few were put together from nothing more than the cardboard from packing crates. Everywhere was the mania of life. Women scrubbing laundry in open tubs, men braising ears of maize in smoky little charcoal fires, children, dogs, cats, chickens, even a lonesome, scrawny goat. Incessant noise assaulted the ears, and an overpowering smell hit the nose. The kind of infusing stench that sticks inside your nostrils, your hair, and your clothes so that you worry you might never get rid of it. This was produced in the main by steaming mounds of uncollected garbage. Regularly, we had to take giant steps across gutters that ran with stinky water. We turned a corner at the mud plaster hut of the chairperson for the Sex Workers Committee. Lynette rapped briskly on the door and then, not waiting for an answer, pushed through. "Hello," she rang out. The hut was a tiny two-room affair, and in the second room, where I could see the corner of a big bed beyond a half-open curtain, the chairperson of the Prostitutes Committee was just completing some business. A startled-looking middle-aged man scrambled to do up his trousers. I was embarrassed, though nobody else seemed to be. "I see you've got company," Lynette said cheerily. The chair of the sex workers' committee was a large woman with a round pumpkin of a face topped by a pad of fluffy hair. She sat upright, a robe half covering her silk slip. Then, when Lynette disappeared behind the curtain for a conference, the client, a man with a broad, guileless face, didn't hurry away as one might have expected, but took a seat in the kitchen where he and I eyeballed one another awkwardly. I couldn't help thinking how unlike a brothel this place was, not to mention that the absolute last thing I'd have wanted to consider was having sex. But then it wasn't my taste in eroticism that was going to prevail. The tradition of prostitution in these shantytowns, I'd been told, went back some 80 years to the days of the railroad construction and was more akin, in fact, to a landlady and her tenants. In the early days, prostitutes were the true landlords, the only people to own their own huts. The customers were transient workers away from home needing and wanting, more than anything, their laundry done, meals, a bed in which to sleep. The provision of sex came merely as part of a full-service boarding house. Now, however, it appeared it was just sex. Eventually, the fellow across from me seemed happy enough to talk. He told me his name was Benson, and when I asked what he did for a living, he answered proudly, "I am a church worker." Then, as sort of an afterthought, "An Anglican." He was not, it turned out, a proper cleric, but a sort of verger in charge of looking after a church building downtown. The walls of the room were painted a well-scuffed blue. A couple of tattered AIDS posters served as decoration. The only thing shiny and new was an economy-sized jar of Vaseline. The lion's share of space was taken up by a gigantic box almost as big as a refrigerator, prominently labeled USAID, 100 gross of condoms meant to be distributed around the neighborhood to the various other women. Through the flapping shutter of the window, I could see children hopping back and forth across puddles of sewage. The chair of the prostitutes committee emerged from the other room, dressed now in a sleeveless shift, and was introduced to me by Lynette. "Missouri," I said. I'd learned a few Swahili terms and figured this would be the time to use them. The woman looked a bit bemused. She was quite large, and with Lynette, me, and Benson, the room was pretty much filled. Still, the outside door pushed open and two more people squeezed in, a small child and a woman, another sex worker. "Missouri," I said again. This time everybody started to snicker. Lynette looked at me. "Forgive us," she said, "but we have to correct you." Confused, I wondered what I'd done. Lynette went on patiently. "In Swahili, there are two parts to the greeting, Habari and Missouri," she said, "which are the equivalent in English of the question, how are you? And then the answer, I am fine." I realized instantly what I'd been doing. "You are turning it around," she continued. "Without waiting to be asked, you are greeting people by saying, I am fine, I am fine." Everybody had a good laugh at the visiting white man's expense, and Benson, finally enjoying some male camaraderie in a room crowded with women, chucked me on the shoulder. Abruptly, however, the mood then shifted. "Tell Larry about your work," Lynette instructed. "He wants to know about commercial sex workers." The two sex worker women looked at one another, and then, in the complaining manner in which a factory laborer might deplore everything from the boss to paltry wages, launched into a kind of lengthy discursion. Here, wages or prices were decidedly paltry, 50 to 200 Kenyan shillings per encounter, about $1 to $5. And the work was undisputably tedious and repetitive. The women meandered around these laments for a bit before getting to the core of the matter, both for them and for me, AIDS, and the issue of their sisters becoming ill with it, dying, and leaving their children as orphans with no one but the other prostitutes to look after them. This was a great burden. "What are you going to do?" the newly arrived sex worker asked, moving with urgency right into my face. "What is the West going to do?" Another half hour passed, at which point Lynette got up and commenced slapping hands in farewell. She and I were going to leave. Benson waited behind, a hopeful look pasted on his broad face. Out in the street, the main traffic remained children who swarmed us. "Hey, Mzungu," they chirped in their little voices, meaning white man. "How are you?" The only English phrase they knew. I'm here because of a book I've written, The Uncertain Business of Doing Good, Outsiders in Africa. And I need to say right off the bat that this is not a book about Africa so much as it is about us. That is, we who are Westerners, North Americans, and Europeans. And it's about the relationship we have, pretty much on our own terms, I dare say, most of the time, with the continent of Africa and the peoples who make up the African continent. I characterize the relationship using the words "our terms," because when we go back to the early days when the linchpins of connection were the slave trade or King Leopold's resource exploitation or British and French and Belgian and Dutch and Portuguese and German, did they leave anybody out? Colonization and missionarization, there wasn't a great deal of negotiation with local peoples. And I want to raise the question whether there's been a great deal of negotiation since then, even when the relationship is supposed to be more benign or hopefully positive. I'll add a little bit to the background that I mentioned earlier. I've spent my life as a journalist and documentary maker. In the early 1990s, 1992, I got an opportunity to make a film in Angola about the peace process that had occurred at that moment in the lengthy civil war that followed hard on the heels of the War of Independence from Portugal. I have to confess, I barely knew where Angola was, but off I went. I had the good fortune to have an African crew who I rendezvoused with in Harare, a camera guy from Mozambique, and a sound recordist from Zimbabwe, and we went to Angola where we signed up with a Canadian NGO employee from Edmonton, and he took us through the maze of both city and country in Angola, where we rendezvoused with church people and with UN peacekeepers and with UN people who were there overseeing the incipient elections, and we made our film. More about that later when we get into our discussion, if you want to talk about Angola a little bit more. But as one thing leads to another, opportunities after that came up to return a number of times to a number of countries over the next decade and a half. I went to Zimbabwe and Kenya and Tanzania. In each case, my job was to make films about or write about people who were, like me, outsiders, Europeans and North Americans, undertaking serious projects of scientific research, AIDS intervention, refugee protection, carrying out criminal trials for those charged by the UN in the massacres in Rwanda. And I made these films and I wrote my articles, and then after a pause, decided to write this book, an attempt to reflect on those enterprises that I had followed and written about and made films about over those years. The title, The Uncertain Business of Doing Good, sometimes gets interpreted as a broad criticism of all attempts at enterprises that are ignited from here and take place in Africa. And I need to assure you that that's not quite so, but it is a recognition that Getting things right is indeed a tricky business. Foreign aid or interventions on the part of people from one part of the world in the lives and affairs of people elsewhere is not a slam dunk. And not even the idea from which it comes, the idea of doing good, is entirely straightforward. Let me say a little bit about the notion of doing good in quotations. Doing good is one of those terms that it's hard to define in a tidy, all-encompassing way. It can be the action of responding to requests for aid from those in need, but it can also be an action of providing aid unbidden. That is, an act whereby one defines somebody else's needs, independent of the wishes of that targeted person, and inserts oneself into that situation. Now, if you'll bear with me while we examine this, both undertakings are tricky. In the former, a relationship of care and trust is demanded, and it needs to be constrained by strict limits. It's not easy to ask for charity, and it's not easy to receive charity. People asking for help already have put their dignity on the line. The other kind, however, where we presume to give aid unbidden, is even more chancy. Some years ago, when I still lived in Winnipeg, just before Christmas, there was a knock on my door, and I opened to find a couple of high school kids with a hamper, and realized quite quickly what it was. My address had been found its way onto the list of those less fortunate who required a Christmas hamper. And it was a nice hamper. There was a turkey in there and cranberry sauce and a couple of Pepsis probably. Anyway, we soon sorted things out, and they figured out that they had the wrong address and they'd have to go on their way and that kind of thing. But what I realized from that experience was how irritating it was. It's funny in retrospect, but at that moment, I was offended that somebody should think I needed this turkey and this hamper. And so, when the Nairobi-based economist James Shikwati tells us that a lot of the charity sent to Africa puzzles people, or actually makes them feel bad, this is what he's talking about. When we presume to give aid or charity unbidden, it not only intrudes on the lives of the targeted receivers, it can lead to or stem from delusions on the parts of the givers or deliverers. The most unsettling example of this, perhaps, is the notion in the minds of the leadership of the United States and Britain that they were doing good by the invasion of Iraq, or Canada, for that matter, by participating in the mission in Afghanistan. We find it hard, nevertheless, to turn away from either the need or the opportunity to do good, for it cries out at the universal human spirit and is deeply embedded in the culture, certainly, of the West. The American founding father, Thomas Jefferson, wrote, "Nature hath implanted in our breasts a love of others, a sense of duty to them, a moral instinct, which prompts us irresistibly to feel and succor their distresses." Some not so latent missionary spirit persists on a central plinth in even our secular culture. It's at the core of much of the narrative of our media that loves to bring us tales of misery and woe and demand, by implication, action. It's also at the core of what we like to think is the best of our spirit, our idealism, our values of unselfishness, our willingness to share at least the surpluses of our material wealth, our knowledge, our skill and humanity, in a world where those exist in perpetual imbalance. And so it's hard to decry or devalue these moral instincts that at face value should contribute to a better world. What does this all have to do with Africa? Well, of all the places in the world, Africa, which we usually persist in taking as a whole rather than 50-some separate countries, many tribes and languages, at least three major religious traditions, has been where we in the West turn our attention around the need to do good. I was alerted earlier this afternoon by Brendan that even Jack Bauer in 24 has gone to Africa in order to redeem himself. When I was a child in rural Ontario, one of the few entertainments was when missionaries visited our church. They were almost always from Africa. And as the lights went down and the slideshow commenced, the message was twofold. The mysteries of the dark continent wended their ways into our fertile little rural Ontario imaginations to tell us that this was indeed an exotic place and a place where our stirring around was both noble and God-ordained. In our nearby town, there was a family of Livingstones for whom one of my grandmothers worked, descendants of the fabled missionary doctor. So I was deeply imbued, as perhaps has been the experience of some of you, with notions about this faraway place and our connections to it. All of which has set on the ground a simplistic rather than complex way of looking at Africa. Africa is sufficiently exotic and far enough away that outsiders have always been able to approach it with a kind of untroubled certainty. This was true whether there was blatant exploitation on their minds or more benign purposes. I would argue that it's no less the case for someone looking to cure HIV/AIDS or prod development in the early years of the 21st century as it was when the motivating forces were anti-slavery, missionarizing for Christianity, or delivering the quote-unquote benefits of colonialism in the 19th and 20th. Part and parcel of the package is an assumption of ownership that I don't think we do or dare assert toward any other part of the world. A possession that one takes either literally, as did the 19th century colonialists, or in a more figurative, emotional, or psychological sense. Not long ago on television, I saw Margaret Trudeau, the former wife of the late Prime Minister, freshly returned from an Ethiopian village where a charity she participates in, a very good charity, had installed water tanks. She told the interviewer with not the slightest irony about my Africa. We all recall the pop star Madonna a couple of years ago returning with great fanfare from picking up a newly adopted child from an orphanage in Malawi. Though it was reportedly her first trip to the continent, let alone the country, she had promised to give millions to such orphans, so why shouldn't she be allowed to take one of them home? The point is, we presume a great deal when it comes to Africa, and we let that presumption spill out without the least sense of shame or even self-consciousness. All news out of Africa is bad, the famous travel writer Paul Theroux wrote. Typical Theroux, he continued, it made me want to go there. Yet Africa, for the serious outsider, is more than anything else frustrating. I can't help but think of the two Canadians who are most well known because of their involvements in and their books about Africa, Stephen Lewis and General Romeo Dallaire. If you think about it, almost all their experiences have been frustrating, and the stories they tell are about those frustrations. Everything that comes to us from Africa both provokes us and simultaneously frustrates us. Bad news evokes a reaction that for the most part is automatic. Somebody, we say, by this we mean somebody from the outside, must do something. My wife always wants to invade Zimbabwe at the moment. Yet hand in hand with the urgent need to intervene, we are, as was Dallaire, similarly paralyzed. Our words and pronouncements gallop fast ahead while our actions remain hesitant and stymied. But if we from the outside world are in some sense perpetually paralyzed by Africa, in the spirit of reciprocity, we return the favor. We place Africa into a kind of box where only certain outcomes are deemed possible. All news out of Africa is bad. But it's not simply that it's bad, it is that it comes through a certain kind of filter that then leads irrevocably to only a certain kind of conclusion. On the day I was writing this, I had the newspaper in front of me. Stories from Congo, stories from Zimbabwe, seemingly intractable violence and cross-border interferences in one, intractable stupidity and bad governance and disregard for the well-being of citizenry in the other. Meanwhile, on my television, a charity was carrying out a fundraiser. The bait was the usual starving children, black children in some country that must have been identified, but in the absence of knowing that, could be any of a number of countries. There was a standard dusty red earth landscape, a drought, the hovering prospect of cholera or malaria, malnutrition. The video children, seated on the ground in front of the earthen walls of crude huts, drained powdered milk from plastic cups provided by the charity, while their mothers, weary looking with vacant, distant eyes, waited just off center. There were no African men present in this scene. Everyone's clothing is ragged and flies are stuck to the mucus of the children's nostrils. A concerned looking white person steps before the camera to make the requisite request for money. Now these two items identify a problem, or more specifically, they're symptoms of the problem. Though intended for wholly different purposes, both of them work to exactly the same end, which is to perpetuate an image of Africa as victim, Africa as helpless, Africa as chaos. There is, of course, more than a kernel of truth here. Nobody will dispute that there are malnourished children with malaria or AIDS or orphaned by AIDS, just as there are stretches of landscape parched by drought, wars and corruption and atrocities, which is the problem with stereotypes. They, on some level, reflect truth, even at the very same moment as they are untrue. But the stereotype sets up something even more disturbing. Africa, helpless, passive, chaotic, is a child. We outsiders, from the most charitable do-gooder to the most rapacious colonialist plunderer, from the multinational oil company looking for a surefire gusher to the erstwhile rock star turned into a campaigner for foreign aid, have infantilized an entire continent. And like a child, it can only be managed, looked after, done to. Africa responds, in one sense, by playing into this. A few years ago, I recall it being reported that Robert Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe, so properly reviled by much of the outside world, had been given us an ovation by the continent's ruling elite gathered in Pretoria. This seemed puzzling. Why had this leader, so many right thinkers believed they should treat as a pariah, received such homage? However, if one accepts the theory that the response he got had to be because of his having stood up to and thumbed his nose at Britain and Europe and America, it becomes clear. His infantilized sisters and brothers recognized that Mugabe had taken the next step. He had become the rebellious teenager. The adjacent implications, however, are deeply disturbing. In 2004, Wangari Maathai, a professor of veterinary medicine at a Kenyan university, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her work organizing small collectives of rural women to plant trees and reforest the country. Many in North America and Europe were astonished. Every report stated how unexpected the choice had been. But what was it that was unexpected? That a somewhat obscure African professor should receive this prize? The moment, by any measure, was amazing. The recognition of small steps by someone working very locally to address both environmental urgency and grassroots and female power. But the astonishment at both the Greenbelt Movement's success and the recognizing of one of its leaders betrayed a different and highly problematic attitude. It went something like this. How could something so good, so effective, as the Greenbelt Movement come out of the heads of people as passive and helpless as we had come to believe Africans to be? Could it possibly happen without some North American or European NGO organizing and paying for it? Surely Bono must have been behind it. Africa, despite being a multifaceted, highly variegated continent, comprised of, as I said before, more than 50 countries, hundreds of tribes, several language groups, and a variety of religions, gets far too often reduced to a single dimension, that of a child. This child is either innocent and helpless and available for the rest of us to save, or wayward and driving us like exasperated parents to our wit's end. The problem is that once you get into the habit of looking at things in this way, it's difficult to break the habit. All assumptions, all discussions, work only inside that paradigm, and the paradigm can never be escaped. But unfortunately, because of both the stereotype and the paradigm, Africa and African people remain unequal with the rest of the world in that most basic of ways: what we believe they can do. We look at them and decide that we cannot expect much. You have a right to some solutions, or some ideas in here, for better or worse, or a few things that I've come to think. And I'll throw these out, and we can hopefully talk more about them in the time that remains. Objectively, we know that African people are not all helpless. There are competent, visionary people everywhere. Objectively, we know that fair trade with decent prices for commodities like coffee and cotton and sustainable contracts around extracted resources like oil, copper, hardwood would benefit more people than all foreign aid combined. Objectively, we understand the disastrous nature of the brain drain, where skilled people like doctors and nurses leave to take better paying jobs in our countries. And this absurdity from the British government's Commission for Africa last year, which suggested that the number of skilled migrants leaving the continent was pretty close to the number of foreign technical experts being sent in as part of Western NGO projects or foreign aid packages. In other words, for every expert sent to help Africa, a doctor, engineer, lawyer, governmental analyst, teacher, environmental planner, agricultural researcher, an educated African national exits in the other direction. And then there are the African voices, like the Kenyan economist I mentioned earlier, James Shikwati, a chap who gets viewed cautiously by many Westerners because of his ties to American neoconservative think tanks. But you can't dismiss the publicity he's gained. For God's sake, please stop the aid, he told the German magazine Der Spiegel. And his critique is that Africans are taught to be beggars rather than independent. Does this mean there's no role for those of us who care about the world and our sisters and brothers? I would say, of course not. But it puts things inside a radically different frame.